States. My name is Peter Bell. I serve as the global co-chair of the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and HIV/AIDS, an independent, time-limited alliance of researchers, policymakers, practitioners, advocates, and people living with HIV. Our collective goal is to scientific evidence space and practice. Specifically, we extreme poverty, expand access to essential services, strengthen families and communities, and provide better outcomes for children. The initiative brings together hundreds of experts from more than a dozen countries, along with a broad range of partners. It has yielded more than 50 research papers and synthesis reports, which examine the state-of-the-art evidence on the situation of children, families, and communities affected by the epidemic. We also seek promising new approaches to addressing their needs. In addition to research, the Joint Learning Initiative convened an international symposium nearly a year ago on evidence-informed action for affected children. And we have sought to inform global policy processes, such as the upcoming Global Partners Forum in Dublin. Our final report will be released toward the end of 2008. Our session this evening caps a very full week of activity for the initiative, starting with the pre-conference symposium on children and HIV/AIDS, and most remarkably, this morning's plenary speech by Linda Richter, the first plenary address on children and HIV/AIDS in the conference's 23-year history. We appreciate the depth of experience in this audience and look forward to your feedback as we share key findings that are emerging from the 18-month period of intensive research, consultation, debate, and reflection. This session will feature some of our findings to date and discuss their implications for action. So what has emerged? As suggested by the title of this satellite, the evidence gathered to date in the Joint Learning Initiatives process has underscored the need to reframe and broaden the response to children in the context of AIDS, and to go beyond orphans to all children affected by the epidemic, particularly those living in poverty. We have also concluded that the best way to support affected children is to support the families and communities that care for them. This requires a sea change in the way we work. This evening, we're going to have three introductory keynote speakers, and then we're going to turn to four panelists. And let me begin by introducing our first keynote speaker. He is Michel Sidibe, who is Assistant Secretary General and Deputy Executive Director of Programs at UNAIDS. Michel started his career in Mali with the NGO Terre des Hommes. As a UNICEF country representative in several African countries, Michel devoted 20 years to children's well-being, focusing on issues of malnutrition, abduction, and the AIDS epidemic. He joined UNAIDS in 2001, where he has played a strategic role in mobilizing support in some 130 countries for scaling up prevention, treatment, and care for AIDS, with the goal of universal access. Michelle will provide a global update on the situation of children affected by the epidemic and current challenges confronting the global response. Michelle Sidibe.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for giving me the opportunity to make an intervention during this important session on children and HIV/AIDS. The problems faced by children living with HIV/AIDS are one of the most challenging and critical issues confronting us today. A child has a right to be a child in order to become a mature and responsible adult. But we fail to place the children at the center of the HIV/AIDS programmatic response. Therefore, it is a great honor for me to be able to highlight tonight our concern during this satellite meeting. Children living with HIV are among the world's most vulnerable people, and on top of it, often among the most ignored of the vulnerable. The effect of this tragedy is probably immeasurable, in particular the psycho-emotional impact. But let me try to take stock of some rather frightening statistics. Worldwide, about 2 million children are living with HIV/AIDS. Over the last 5 years, HIV/AIDS has killed an estimated 1.5 million children. According to UNICEF, more than 13 million children under the age of 15 have lost one or both parents to AIDS. Each day, 1,200 children under the age of 15 are newly infected with HIV, half of whom will die before they are 2 years old. These figures are shocking, Mr. Chair, yet they do not truly reflect the suffering of these children and their family. I remember when I was still UNICEF representative in Uganda, visiting Gulu in the northern part of the country. And I can tell you, when I was in this rehabilitation center, I had this difficult day, difficult moment, meeting with young girls, 14 years old. She was adopted by Lord Resistance Army. She was raped. She was pregnant, and she was HIV/AIDS positive. It was very difficult because she was in this rehabilitation center, cut from her family, not able to continue to go to school. That is the complexity of this epidemic. The impact of the HIV pandemic on communities has been devastating since a long time. It has contributed to the destruction of economy and social structures. Coping mechanisms become increasingly weakened as more households in a community are affected and family and communal support network are less and less able to cope. But we should not regard ourselves as helpless bystanders. We can do something, and we must do everything, because progress is possible. There are many examples of positive changes. Death among children has declined by 16%. New infections have declined by 20%. And the PMTCT program's coverage has increased from 14% to 33% in just 2 years. More and more countries are defining strategies to ensure care and support, including protection for children affected by HIV. We must coordinate our effort and ensure that we address the children affected by HIV in the way that represents their life as a whole, and not as a set of isolated problems. Why? Because children cannot be seen in isolation from the rest of the community in which they live. They are an inherent part of the society. Older people provide health care and education for children, passing on social, cultural values and norms. And many of the interventions to address the drivers of the epidemic will have impact on the lives of children, including striving for gender equality and women's rights. It is not enough to talk about the problems of children affected by HIV, including those orphaned because of HIV, without also addressing the surrounding issues which are aggravated their vulnerability. This means doing everything possible to remove stigma in the ignorance on which it is based. It means working to keep family intact to the greatest extent possible to ensure that a child affected by HIV is able, as any other child, to grow up in an atmosphere of love and care, and to benefit from the strength of its family and community environment. This means also addressing the education right and retaining the children affected by HIV between formal school system and abolishing school fees. This means promoting cash transfer to communities to assist poor families. This means strengthening the economic base of caregivers and increase the capacity of poor families to protect and support their children. This means supporting community care coalition through development of comprehensive and integrated family-centered services. This means enhancing the capacity of families and community to respond to the psychological needs of children living with HIV. The global commitment of universal access calls for aggressive scaling up. The comprehensively reach out to children, family needs to be at the center of the delivery system. Vulnerability that place children at risk of HIV infection need to be tackled. And fund must quickly reach the community levels where the biggest problems are. It is time to make a difference to the life of children. AIDS has been the engine for unveiling the need for health system strengthening. Let's now make it the engine for social protection. Thank you.
Well, our second speaker will be Dr. Agnes Binigwahu. I have the great pleasure to serve as co-chair with Agnes of the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and HIV/AIDS. It is a real joy to work with her. And she is the Executive Secretary of Rwanda's National AIDS Control Commission. In addition to overseeing the planning, monitoring, and evaluation of all activities connected with the fight against HIV/AIDS in Rwanda, Agnes represents her country in various global bodies, including the Global Fund, the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, and PEPFAR. An emergency pediatrician by training, Agnes also finds time to practice in her pediatric work part-time in Kigali. She's going to talk with us this evening about a focus on the family as being key for children's well-being, and she will draw on her experience in Rwanda. Please welcome Agnes Binigwaho.
Good evening. Good evening. Ah, that's better. Dear colleagues and friends, it's a great pleasure for me and an honor to be with you and to share with you some results that are emerging from the work of the Journaling Initiative on Children and AIDS. I'm really convinced that the initiative funding will enable government and development partners to deliver more effective response to children needs in the context of HIV and AIDS. It is clear out of the finding of the research that the response have to be family-centered. First, let us remind ourselves the magnitude of the epidemic, and I'm not going to insist because Michelle has already said a lot of that, but the impact on children is huge. Even in countries where there is strong political will, sound policies, enormous challenge persist. In the front line of AIDS fight, families and communities have responded to children's needs with courage and resilience. But the vast majority of families have received only minimal support from outside sources, including government. If we look at the situation of sub-Saharan Africa, families and communities affected by AIDS largely live in poverty. These poor families and communities continue to bear almost the whole financial cost of caring for children affected by HIV and AIDS. A solid body of research confirms that children flourish best in families. No other social institution can replace families' care for children, but the formal response to date has not built on the strength of families or communities. Jelica's research brings the case for family-centered action into clear focus. The vast majority of AIDS affected children in sub-Saharan Africa are taking care in families. 80% of children classify as orphan have a surviving parent. We always forgot that. More than 90% are care of in foster family, but with relatives. That means if we want to strengthen the life of those children, if we want to care of them, we need to strengthen their extended family who are caring for them. To create institutional structure that try to replace or bypass families is inefficient, and the results are poor. We need to build on what families are already doing for children and help them to even do better. How does family-centered approach shape the delivery of specific services? My colleague here, Jim Kim and Lauren, will address this issue in a greater detail shortly. But rapidly, what I can say is that we have to take the whole family as a unit of intervention, not just an individual child in that family. Reaching additional family members with services multiplies the impact of programs. I have seen many families that have taken one or two children as foster children, and were able to access care, treatment, school, overall health for those children because they had a foster status, while those families cannot care for their own biological children. What can happen in those situations? And this illustrates This is a great illustration of the distorted system that is still being widely applied today in the world. In contrast, a family-centered approach aims to do more than improve children's outcomes in a short run. It's also improved the long-term family capacities so families can care better for children over the whole course of their development. Working through families is cost-effective. We know that institutional care costs 8 to 14 times more per child with the worst outcome. Children and families need HIV-related healthcare and intervention, but they need more than that. To succeed the family-centered approach, we must strengthen families in all dimensions of the well-being of children. This includes health, education, housing, psychological needs, and economic security. I want to give you an example of what we have done in Rwanda. In Rwanda, the government has identified support for vulnerable children and youth as a critical national strategy for development. We have understood that the future of the country will be undermined by thousands of children denied education. Don't forget that in 1994 we had a horrific genocide, and this genocide left thousands and thousands of children orphaned or detached by their biological family. So what we did in 2005, we start a program called Giving the Full Package to Children. And this was not easy. In the beginning, partners were refused it, because when you give pockets of intervention to children, you count thousands of beneficiaries. But those thousands of beneficiaries got nothing in the end of the day. And partners were reluctant. It was in 2005, and they told us, never, not possible. We didn't give up. And now those partners are happy because they see that we provide better quality of services to children, and that those children have greater chance now to become adults who will be productive to the society. To drive this agenda, the government has adopted a national strategic plan for orphan and vulnerable children. The plan stipulates that children must receive the full package, and this package is costed. And this package contains what I have just talked about now. The delivery mechanism of the minimum package has been designed and implemented. And as I told you, the partners were reluctant in the beginning, but now I have even the pleasure to say that it is implemented like that in other countries, because our partners as PEPFA have reflected on the fact that thousands of children receive just shoes, school uniform, without housing will get nothing, without health will get nothing. How we managed to do it from 2005 in Rwanda? We have a division of labor. The national government set up the overall policy, regulate the funding flows, ensure the geographic equity, and monitor the results of program at national level. At local level, each district is run by a mayor and his team, and an annual joint forum meeting brings together the local government, the partners, NGOs working at district level, and together they define the need of the district to implement the national plan, the national strategy, in light of the local situation and opportunities. The district mayor coordinates the local response and is accountable to the population and to the central government. Regularly, they give a report every quarter on performance of the district, each partners. The report is given through the mayor, and the responsible is the mayor. I'm working in the National AIDS Control Commission, and all the reports sit on my desk, you know, one day. But the report have to come through the mayor. If it's not the mayor who signed, I threw it in the dustbin. And I called the governor and said the mayor didn't report. This is to assure that the local government own the process. At the grassroots level, the community is in charge to identify the vulnerable families and children. And it's those families identified by their pair who are in the list as beneficiaries at district level. The role of NGO at district level is to provide the services according to the working agenda that have been decided during the joint forum and according a plan with a budget and indicators. And they report on quarterly basis to the mayor, and the mayor compiled the report and send it to the National AIDS Control Commission, and me, I send it to the government. In the civil society, we doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. If we already, we can use better what exists. I can give an example of the faith-based organization. They have an enormous presence in all over Africa. They are everywhere, even in remote areas. And a recent survey done by Jelica showed that in 6 countries in Africa, out of 686 faith-based organizations interviewed and assessed, only 11% of them say that they don't deal with OVCs. Another advantage is that the faith-based organizations have a lower running cost than majority of NGOs. And they have a direct link with families and vulnerable families in particular. So you can see that the overall division of labor in Rwanda, with the central government, the local government, the NGO district level, and the communities, bring synergy in all this. So Jelica research show something. Is that the majority of families affected by HIV/AIDS live in extreme poverty, and that the impact of HIV/AIDS increase household poverty and absorb the resources of those poor families. So if we are serious about protecting the children, then we need to design policy that enable affected families to achieve the basic economic security of those children. Only when families enjoy such a security, they can provide good care to children. Policy promote families' economic strengthening are the leading edge of more effective response for children in a world affected by HIV/AIDS. Now we know that to provide support to poor, we need to pass through national social protection program. There is no single bullet. There is no magic bullet. We need to provide many types of intervention according to the environment of those children if we want to succeed. There are many forms of action that can advance social protection, but all of them have to focus on sustainability, and we have to create mechanisms to increase the economic empowerment of those families. One among others, and I will say one among others, social protection option which is effective is cash transfer program. This program enables poor families to purchase services such as schooling, housing and health, while also it helps those families to become economically productive. The income transfer option must be adapted to the country-specific environment, such has been shown in Bangladesh, India, and even here with our partner here and great keynote speaker today, Julio Frank. We have this program called, and I hope I pronounce it properly, Oportunidades program. And it's totally different of the situation in Africa, because the rate of HIV is different, the situation of vulnerable children is different, but we can take lesson out of that in the implementation of our own program. And I guess that Dr. Julio Frank is going to speak about that. Be sure, my dear friends, I'm happy to see you here, because I'm sure that if the recommendation of the Jelica studies are going to be implemented all together, we are going to change the life of millions of children all over the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Agnes. As Agnes has stated, our final keynote speaker is Julio Frank, the former Minister of Health of Mexico and recently announced Dean of the Harvard University School of Public Health. Over the past several years, Julio has split his time between Seattle, where he is a senior fellow at the Global Health Program of the Gates Foundation, and Mexico, where he leads the Carso Health Institute. And as Agnes said, during his tenure as Minister of Health, he was really the major architect of Oportunidades, a conditional cash transfer program that has delivered help to millions of Mexican families living in poverty. And in his keynote, he's going to talk about some of that experience and its relevance to the context in which JLICA, or the Joint Learning Initiative, has been working. Please join me in welcoming Julio Frank, who was greeted when we visited Oportunidades yesterday as a real hero by people in the communities which we visited. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you to the co-chairs of the Joint Learning Initiative for this opportunity. I think it's very much in the spirit of the Joint Learning Initiative to broaden the perspective when analyzing the challenges surrounding children who live with HIV/AIDS or who live in communities deeply affected by HIV, to have invited me in order to share with you the experience of a specific program dealing with the theme that both Michelle and Agnes have so well underscored, the enormous connection between facing that challenge and establishing sustainable and comprehensive systems of social protection. I'd like to open by repeating a sentence that I think is so well structured in the key messages from the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and Age, where it says AIDS is the leading edge of the leading edge of global health and development. It is the motor that can drive improved health services and social protection for the most vulnerable. And I think seeing or placing the role of the fight against HIV/AIDS in the context of this leading edge, of this motor for larger social progress, I think it's exactly the perspective. So what I'd like to do in this few minutes is just give you an overview of a couple of really extremely exciting programs on social protection. They also, and particularly one of them, Oportunidades, that Agnes referred to in her last slide. We understand social protection as the set of mechanisms and programs that protect families from the sources of social shocks that will either throw families into poverty or severely curtail the opportunities of new generations. And almost 10 years ago now, the federal government in Mexico launched this ambitious program called that has been renamed as Oportunidades, exactly to underscore the philosophical base of equality of opportunity for children, children entering life with exactly the same opportunities. The short-term objective was income poverty alleviation, but the medium and long-term objective was really to interrupt the intergenerational transmission of poverty. And one thing we need to understand is that with AIDS, it's not just the virus that is transmissible. It's also the poverty and suffering that gets transmitted from generation through generation. And it's interrupting that part of the cycle of poverty that this program was directed. How did it do it? Through cash transfers, but making them conditional on investments in human capital by achieving synergies between nutrition, education, and health services. And this is a beautiful example of the way of social policies that are integrated in the ground, because I think social policy has been hurt by the sectorial approach where each ministry has its own programs. But when you come to a community, that's it. That's the reality of people living in their communities and then receiving these contradictory packages. I think the nice potential of the concept of social protection is it allows you to integrate in a multi-sectorial fashion a number of interventions. The target population was the households, the families, and it is very much based on families, that are defined as extremely poor in Mexico. And I've been in Rwanda, and yes, as you know, I had the pleasure of visiting you. And believe me, some of our communities are not very different from what I saw in Rwanda. This is a middle-income country, but it's a middle-income country torn by social inequality. And when you get to the extremely poor communities here, I think the reality is, when I was driving through the roads of Rwanda, I felt right at home. It is a very oppressive reality of extreme poverty. So the goal then was to channel investments in nutrition, health, and education through a targeted approach, very much based on children and on women, as I will show, in order to improve outcomes on cognitive development and health status, improving investments in human capital with the expectation that this will increase lifetime income, produce social mobility, and empower people to break out of the cycle of poverty. It is a targeted program, and it's an incredibly transparent program with a number of social auditing mechanisms, so it is completely insulated from partisan use or political manipulation. So it starts by a geographic program. The program started originally only in the rural areas. It was extended a few years ago to the urban areas. In rural, it's a whole community, it's a whole locality, as we call it. In urban areas, it's divided by blocks. The targeting is very fine. It's brought down to the level of what you would call in English census tract. So it's extremely refined. And that defines potentially eligible communities. You then need to have access to education and health services in that community. And then through a very well-developed instrument, it is possible to identify household beneficiary families and then incorporate and enroll them after a whole orientation session where families are informed of what it is, because this is not a handout program. This is based on the notion that equality of opportunity is the ethical foundation of this society, and that therefore all of these are social rights that are enshrined in our Constitution. So these are not handouts. People are informed. People, of course, can reject. It doesn't happen very often. But this is not a something that's imposed. The components and benefits, it's a series of benefits, and they comprise, first of all, education. There is an amount of cash transfer linked to education, to nutrition. The first component is nutrition, and there is an amount of money that's transferred to improve nutrition in families. The fascinating thing is that we were able to develop a nutritional supplement that goes with this, taking into account cultural norms of food, that is targeted for children under 5 and for pregnant or breastfeeding women. I don't know if you tried it when you visit, but it actually tastes very, very, very well. It's been enormously researched and tested, and it is very well accepted. The most important cash transfer, though, is linked to education, and it is construed as a scholarship for children. It started primary schooling. It's now been extended all the way through high school, through secondary schooling. It starts from year 3, and the idea here, from year 3 through graduation, all the way to 21 years of age, potentially. And the idea here was twofold: to get incentives to families to not have children work, and then, you know, to compensate that by transferring cash so that, you know, you don't need to send your children to generate that income. So it's a substitution. But the other interesting thing is that it has a gender focus, because the cash transfer, first of all, it goes up from year to year, so from third year to fourth to fifth to sixth year of primary school, and then through the 6 years of secondary school, it increases for each year. But for every year, it is higher for girls than for boys, because girls are disproportionately discriminated in access to educational services and are more often sent to work than boys. So it has this gender component. The other gender component is that the money is given to the women. And that has completely changed household dynamics in this country. I went today with some colleagues from the Gates Foundation to a very rural, very remote rural community. I just got back here in time for the session. And Tachi Yamada, the president of Global Health, asked them, who manages the money? And all the women said, we manage the money. And what happens with your husbands? And the answer was, they don't even know about the money. You know, we handle this money ourselves. And it has changed the dynamics. There's some evidence that intrafamily violence has been reduced and that it has empowered women because now they have control of a substantial amount of resources. The neat thing here is that once you have this platform, and as I will show in a minute, I will tell you in a minute, this now covers 5 million families, 25 million people, which is a quarter of the population of this country. Mexico has about 107 million people. But once over these 10 years that we have built this platform, it is possible now to add additional elements. So in the face of the rising cost of energy for heating and cooking, there's now an energy supplement that's transferred as cash to families. And now recently, President Calderon announced a food supplement to compensate for the rising prices of food in this country. Similarly, because of our demographic transition and the presence of poor elderly persons, there's now an additional supplement when there is an elderly person. So again, that this doesn't become a burden that distracts resources from children at some point. Let me very quickly, because I'm out of time, tell you that the idea here is conditional cash transfer because there is a sense of co-responsibility. So the money gets transferred in a very efficient way every 2 months. About a third is done now electronically. Particularly the young people, once they graduate from high school, they will receive a lump payment at the end. This is an incentive for graduation, and as long as they open a bank account. And what that is also doing is it's opening financial services for the poor. So that's been a consequence. But the important thing is that this is conditional on families attending health orientation clinics, checkups, and, of course, on kids being in the educational system and the family taking the nutritional supplement for children and pregnant and lactating women. Right now, 68%, 3.5 million families, are in rural areas, the 18% in semi-urban areas, and 14% in urban areas. The last thing I want to underscore is that this is a fantastic example of what Peter was saying. This is evidence-based policy. Because from the beginning, and here I have to say I was not the architect, the creator of this was a dear, dear friend who unfortunately died a few years ago, Jose Gomez de Leon, proud to say that he was a graduate of the Harvard School of Public Health, very dear friend, director of the National Institute of Public Health, where I was also a director many years ago. And he envisioned the idea that we would build a systematic evaluation component. Because of financial and logistical reasons, the program had to be rolled out gradually. You couldn't enroll all the communities at once. So what happened was that communities were matched and communities were randomly allocated to receive the program first or second. Every community would be covered. The issue was timing. But that allowed for a comparison in time, and because of random allocation, we can attribute the change we see to the program. And this is probably the most robust social research, social evaluation of a large-scale program. This was ethically very well-grounded because gradualism was inevitable. We took advantage of that to build an evidence base, and those that came in later got a better program. So although they came in a few months later, it was the difference was just a few months, they actually got all the learning from the first stage. And let me just tell, and this has continued over the 10 years, and it has produced a whole literature that I'm sure many of you know on evaluation, because it's one of the few programs where we can attribute the change to this. Outcomes that are now out there on consumption in the family and investments, about 12% of the cash transfers are invested in productive assets. After 5 years of the program, there was a 34% increase in living standards from the beneficiaries. In food consumption, an increase of 6.4% in energy and calories consumed. In fact, now we're starting to see the opposite problem of obesity. 56% of the children taking now 45 foods, and a great increase in quality. I won't give you more data. But the fantastic thing was, because there was a detailed anthropometric evaluation, it was possible to measure a substantial gain in height from children attributable to the intervention, and a 20% reduction in anemia. And utilization of services also increased about 35%. We started seeing lots of out-of-pocket expenditures as children were living longer. So we added this program of Seguro Popular, and those of you who attended the meeting with the special session with President Clinton, I already spoke about that, but that was the other part of the social protection, was a social insurance program, very much like the Mutualites in Rwanda, again, a great similarity. So we have now documented substantial reductions in out-of-pocket, and especially a very large drop in catastrophic expenditures, because there's no point in sending cash transfers when then that is used for out-of-pocket expenditures for health care. A great improvement in behavior change. And then finally, in education attainment, about a year, one additional year for children 15 to 18, and that is now estimated to it's been translated in the youth in about a 12% increase in income earning through life. So what are the lessons? First of all, I think conditional cash transfer programs can effectively increase demand for services that build human capital and improve health outcomes, provided they are well targeted, that they are conditionalities that are aligned with objectives, and that the conditionalities can be reliably monitored, which is what's been achieved. There's a whole debate whether conditional or unconditional. I think cash transfers are a good idea. Let's try to make them the best possible, but let's get the money to the poor people, and particularly to communities that are devastated by AIDS. And finally, I think the challenge now is to make sure that those services are of good quality, and that concomitant with the cash transfer, that is the population side of the equation, we also strengthen the supply side of the quality of education and of health services. Finally, the lesson is that rigorous prospective impact evaluation is critical to the program's improvement, to its political survival. This program has now survived two changes of administration, thanks to the fact that there was very convincing evidence that it is working. And that's what it takes to build a structural change of this magnitude. So I think partners who fund programs in developing countries should build in systematic evaluation, not as an afterthought, but as something that's there from the beginning. Let me quote, to finish, another sentence from the main messages of the Joint Learning Initiative on Children and AIDS, which says that the future lies not in the elimination of specific programs for AIDS, but in working to integrate the successes of AIDS into health and development more widely. And I think if we take this message, that it's exactly the success we have had in the AIDS community, the need to broaden our perspective when it comes to children, and then finally bring these two strands together into a comprehensive response that doesn't lose the focus on the fact that we need to deal with the AIDS crisis, and at the same time use that as the spearhead to really promote in comprehensive systems of social protection, then I think we will have found the holy grail of the AIDS movement internationally. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you so much. And our process within the Joint Learning Initiative is very much aligned with what Julia Frank has told you. In the interest of time, I'm going to be very brief in my introduction of the next four panelists up here on the stage. Next, and with apologies to them, to Agnes's right, we have Lorraine Scher. Lorraine is a clinical psychologist and head of the health psychology unit in the Department of Infection and Population Studies at University College London. And she is, together with Linda Richter, the co-chair of the Learning Group on Strengthening Families. Next to her is Jurker Ekström. Jurker is a research fellow at the Institute for Development Studies at the University of Sussex. And he has served as a key member of our learning group on social and economic policies. Then next to Jurker is Nathan Nashakira, a Ugandan medical doctor and public health specialist based in Kampala with FAST Africa. FAST is a technical resource team supporting community-based health and development initiatives of faith-based groups, civil society agencies, and local governments. And finally, batting cleanup, if you'll forgive me an American expression, is Jim Kong Kim. Jim Yong Kim is the director of the FXB, Jim Yong Kim is the director of the FXB Center for Health and Human Resources at the Harvard School of Public Health. And he is co-chair, together with Lydia Munga Herrera, of the learning group on family, on services, and on human rights. So why don't we begin with Lorraine? And I would ask each of the panelists to hold themselves to within 10 minutes. Thank you.
Good evening. Oh, you are there. You're all still there. Right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a whirlwind tour of the process that underlines the JLICA. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the Learning Group 1, and I'm going to tiptoe you through some of the findings, and I'll hope you bear with me as I throw to you 2 years of work by about 18 people. I'll try to list the lead authors' names down there, co-chaired with Linda, and try and tell you exactly what we did, what we found. Now, essentially, we believe that the family is closest to the child, and this talk will show the JLICA process by way of example. I'm going to apply a family lens to policy, to knowledge, and findings. I'm going to set out what did we look at and what did we find. So this is really an analysis of the evidence base, what's been done, and what did we find. Now, the list is very long, so you don't have to read it, and it's not comprehensive, but this gives you some idea of the kinds of issues on children that we feel were important, things like prevention in pregnancy, testing, orphan definitions, institutionalized care, and I'm just going to pick a few of those, and I'm going to take you through them. So the first one is HIV prevention in pregnancy. We really see that it's important that we look at conception rather than immediately saying that the child arrives in the family when it's born. There's much that goes on in child, in preparation, and in family life prior to the arrival of the child. HIV, we believe, in HIV prevention in pregnancy benefits children. Sustaining intact families benefits children. Parents, grandparents, siblings, and extended family are a rich resource for the new infant, and it's that basis that drives the next bit of thinking. So HIV in pregnancy, we looked at the quality of testing, the limited concepts around the words of PMTCT, the blame around it. As Stephen Lewis pointed out, we should be using the word vertical transmission, not pitting the mother against the child with mother to child. Testing offered to women only, why not the man? Why not male and couple testing? Uptake, and do people come and return for their results? And what did we find? Well, a family approach suggests that couple testing is better, and father testing, they should be included, we found that that was very rare. A family approach sees that people actually have sex during pregnancy, and that would suggest that you might want to do a repeat test. Again, that is rare. A family approach avoids blame. The quality of VCT that we found was generally poor, it's menu-driven, lay-provided, infant resistance testing is insufficiently studied, and the use of monotherapy is really a problem that needs urgent addressing. Prevention interventions in pregnancy. I put this slide up really because I want to look at a family perspective. What do we do to children? Children are in families. These are the children who we make such examinations. We hold them accountable. They have to go and study. And if they don't do well, and I'm sure all of your children have just been sitting exams, what do we say to them? Go to your room. Buck up. Come on. Not good enough. And what happens with the examination that the world has been sent? 9% of mothers got antiretroviral in 2004. That's 34% in 2007. Any child will tell you that 34% is a failure. 34%, we should say to you, go to your room, buck up, not good enough, get going on your studies. Treatment, rollout of children, well, I won't repeat that slide, we know it's 6%, well, that's an achievement. Orphan definitions, beyond the crisis. Well, the images, what the world has seen, are really often very negative. They pull at the heartstrings, and they evoke pity and fear, the hordes of orphans. And I give you some pictures. If you just Google the word AIDS orphan, that's what you come up with. Let's give you the actual data. This is the data that everyone's quoting in the JLICA. Here's where it comes from. I'll give you Mark Belsey's, and you just have to look at the little orange bit at the end. That's a child who's lost both mother and father. And you've repeated multiple times in all these countries that really we believe psychologically that if a child still has a remaining parent, they really do have a resource that a child with both parents who have died does not have. And those are the countries that we've looked at. Orphan definitions, does it matter? Well, I think it really does matter, because what you find is when you have this blurring concept of who's an orphan, if you look at the literature, and I've listed here all the studies we've carried out, and we've analyzed and reviewed, several hundred of them, but what you can see from the graph is that we don't have much clarity. For most of them, they don't actually define. So when they're saying orphan, we don't know which orphans they're talking about. Are they talking about a child with both lost, with one lost, with either lost, and it's very messy. So if you're going to be evidence-based, you actually have to start with clear definitions. Now, institutionalized care. I was asked to be quick, and you can see my opinions on institutionalized care, but there's good evidence that institutions are not good for child development. There's a range of studies, I won't go over them. The review of the general literature that we did showed that children suffer. It is reversible. So let's start reversing it. Policy implications for family-based provisions are really urgently required. Mobility and separation, no policy on separation. When we looked at the studies, we really saw that there's a lot of separation, and we really believe a family approach would minimize that. A family approach would keep whatever family members are left, keep it intact, whatever and whoever remain. Schooling, well, systematic review. We went through all the literature and we found 15 controlled studies. 13 of the 15 identified a negative effect on schooling of being a child with a parent who's died of AIDS. And lots of problems with the control groups. Poverty is an issue. And if there is free provision of primary school or secondary school in a country, this matters. Nutrition, again, we did a systematic review. 14 controlled group studies found in the empirical data, 10 recorded no nutritional effects and 4 actually noted effects. But most of the studies didn't actually control for the HIV status of the child. Now, it just might matter, because we do know that a child might lose weight if they're positive. So it's very hard to say orphaning leads to a child being malnourished or underweight, but it might be it's the HIV status of the child. So we really need to get the literature clear in order to get our conclusions clear. Those are the studies, just to prove we did do the work. Don't have to read them. Household change. Now I'm going to dip into not only my work now, but some of the other people, because they did really, really good stuff. I think my time's up. Anyway, I'll tiptoe you through. Household change. The bottom line is that households are not changing so much. There's not that many skipped generations, and there's not that many child-headed, and they're often transient. Bereavement, we hear again and again in the conference that 12 million children are orphaned. That means at least 12 million are bereaved. We found 16 studies. What do we know about bereavement? Not a lot. Here they are. Cognitive development, again, we found the literature is chaotic and lots of different measures, but we did find that cognitive development is affected by HIV. Does it matter? It really does matter, because cognitive development and cognitive standard does affect predictions of death and grade attainment for all children. Parental mood matters. Here's cash transfer. This is the 300 documents that Michelle Adato, but in fact I won't go over it because Julia Frank has given you a detailed insight. The crisis literature informs us. Lynn Franco's work on low prevalence countries showed a lot of things in common. And I suppose I'll conclude by saying, if we have a family approach, who fits the bill? Fathers? Well, they do matter. We found studies on fathers, but actually they were all studies on dead fathers. What happens to a child when the father isn't there? Well, come on, we might have some studies on living fathers. They do contribute a bit, you know. Grandparents, we found some studies. Parenting, some lovely systematic reviews. Gender, well, I won't go over the gender thing because everyone's going to throw me off the stage, but there's a poster on it. Basically, we took every single one of the systematic reviews and re-reviewed them, just measuring, did anyone bother to see if it was a boy or a girl? And if so, did they even analyze their data thereby? And you can guess the answer, can't you? They didn't. Global statistics are not even gathered by gender. We just have infant or child. Not by data is often gathered but not analyzed, and that's the numbers. So we really need a mechanism to allow children a look in. We really need to know that it's a false belief that we protect children by wrapping them in bubble wrap. We do not study them and do not generate an evidence-based policies. How good is the evidence? Well, I've shown you where the gaps are. But the worst part of it all is there is some good evidence. And when it is there, we don't listen to it. Lastly, the voices and views of children are often not what we expect, and we need to listen to them. We need to incorporate them. Sometimes they have opinions that we just don't know what they are. And finally, I would just endorse that we all have to really look at a family focus. Bring some families in, not just the one-man band. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Peter and Lorraine. I'm afraid I might disappoint following the, that great array of photographs, at least. I'll be speaking briefly about some research that was commissioned by the Joint Learning Group 4 of the JLICA on the need for new approaches to linking social protection for children, with HIV prevention for children also, or adolescent children. And the question is to prepare as we care, which will become more obvious later, I hope. Just before going on, I'd just like to echo what Peter said about the great news to have first plenary on children and AIDS, but how sad it is that it has taken us 26 years into an epidemic for that to occur. I'd also like to point the finger at the development community, which I'm also a member of, for taking so long to actually engage with the AIDS epidemic. But actually, to look at the positive side of this, children and AIDS has provided an opportunity, I think, to bring the two sectors together in a way that hasn't happened before, and that's around vulnerable children. So in JLICA, we spent a lot of time arguing about what's vulnerability and who are children. We decided to settle for the UN definition of a child as a child under the age of 18. And with vulnerability, it became very clear that the response to AIDS and HIV and AIDS over the decades initially focused very much on a sense of vulnerability related to the risks of HIV infection, and then also on treatment and human rights and so on. Whereas in the development and child welfare sector, we have thought of children as vulnerable, mainly in terms of the impacts of them becoming affected by HIV and AIDS. So those are two very different senses of vulnerability and in development and development economics. This sense of becoming affected then determines how much worse you become affected by another shock happening to you. Anyway, so these two perspectives still don't often meet, and the two sectors often talk at cross purposes and or do not explain what sense of vulnerability they're using. So we asked ourselves, what is the evidence for linkages across these two senses of vulnerability for children? In other words, what are the needs for joined up policies between prevention and protection and care for children, vulnerable children, including children affected by HIV and AIDS? So we commissioned four studies on prevention, amongst lots of other things that we were doing at the initiative. But the studies were two qualitative studies, one in Tanzania and one in India, looking at communities of vulnerable adolescents, particularly girls, in urban areas. We also commissioned a review of the evidence, more quantitative evidence, on the intergenerational linkages from the impact of HIV on children to the vulnerability to infection later in life, carried out by Kluver and Operario at Oxford University. We also commissioned a review on some recent research being done by a number of people, including Kelly Harmon at the Population Council, on the socioeconomic determinants of vulnerability for adolescents. And all of these studies will be published in the forthcoming IDS Bulletin on Children and AIDS. They were focused primarily on sub-Saharan Africa, as was mentioned earlier about Lynn Franco's evidence from other parts in low-prevalence countries. Many of the findings hold in other settings as well. A quick disclaimer, I've talked of two senses of vulnerability, to becoming infected, to the effects of being affected by HIV or AIDS. There is a third sense of vulnerability, which is in between, which is being infected, and of course, children who are infected by HIV have particular needs, and I just want to say that we didn't cover that area. That's obviously a very important area. It's a smaller number of children, but their needs are even more complex. So let me move on to some of our findings. First of all, as one might expect, we did find impact from being affected by AIDS or HIV and AIDS in families to the chances of becoming infected later in life, particularly in adolescence. Orphans are typically more sexually vulnerable than other children are, and orphan girls particularly so, as fairly well understood by most, partly that's to do with sexual activity starting younger for girls than for boys. And we may not know enough about what happens to boys in their early 20s because they're no longer children and we're no longer studying them. So that might be something to look out for. Secondly, the death of a parent, the death of a parent of the same sex as the child is particularly significant, and that's both for girls and for boys. So a girl losing her mother is more impacted, and a boy losing his father, becomes more vulnerable as a result. Now, parental illness and death can cause psychological impacts on psychological well-being, which is fairly obvious to most people, but also results in higher vulnerability and risk behavior in adolescents. And that is the key finding in terms of linking impact mitigation, if you like, with prevention for older children. So, aside from those personal impact of crisis in the family on the children psychologically, etc., there are poverty and issues of poverty and inequality, and we also need to look at. Adolescent girls, for example, are particularly affected by a combination of orphaning and poverty, making them particularly vulnerable to sexual risk. Poor adolescents display an earlier sexual debut, higher rates of transactional sex, lower levels of control in negotiating, for example, condom use, and they also experience higher level of sexual abuse or violence. The Tanzania study, for example, in interviews with children who were engaged in selling sex, found that 75% of those children were actually orphans. If you're wondering about the other 25%, all of them came from families with only one natural parent. Then we also looked at education and social inclusion, if you like. And certainly, parental illness and death has been shown to impact on children's education, again, particularly so with maternal orphaning, and particularly so for girls. I'm not sure if that came out clearly on the slide, but that echoes with here in Mexico, for example, with Oportunidades interventions. Some research show that schools, including some of the Tanzania research we carried out, shows that schools can be places of sexual risk and that exploitation takes place, particularly for vulnerable girls, but also for boys. And this is clearly unacceptable. However, overall, participation in education does lower sexual risk, early pregnancies, other sexual health problems, and HIV vulnerability. And this is crucial, particularly for girls in higher grades of primary education, but also secondary education, of course, which we don't have universal secondary education pushes yet. Okay, importantly, it's also important to point out that sexual vulnerability has been shown to be mitigated by children's participation and social capital, if you like, or participation in groups outside the school or the home, be it clubs, social church groups, sports clubs, dancing groups, etc., etc. That's very important for children's vulnerability, and that may be constrained by HIV-related stigma discrimination as well. Some of the implications of all of these findings is that we do need to think much more seriously, like here in Mexico, about joining up policy and programming between OVC impact mitigation, if you like, or social protection for poor children and affected children, and then with adolescent HIV prevention and sexual health, sexual and reproductive health programs. The common prevention strategies that we still see, even though we knew this, I think, certainly over a decade ago, that rely on generic messages such as ABC, they're often very poorly targeted, both in their messages and in how they're carried out. And worse, aside from sometimes being counterproductive, they're certainly irrelevant to the personal, social, and structural sources of vulnerability of most of the affected children we're talking about here. Solutions need to be tailored to the specific context and to the specific groups of children who may become vulnerable. We can't give I'd like to be able to, but we certainly can't give blueprint solutions to problems which are shaped by multidimensional local contexts, which may be disappointing, but it is encouraging to see this discussion being aired much more at this conference than before. It's coming back. How do we actually develop programs around structural prevention? Okay, in terms of targeting, our findings, if just to dispel any misunderstandings, our findings do not suggest that we should be targeting AIDS orphans at all. But they do identify that we have to identify, they point to the need to identify the most vulnerable children and actually get them involved in prevention. Sorry, I see my time's running out. So let me just very quickly skip through the social protection should be concerned with orphans and vulnerable children, as we heard, as there are good examples of. Let me just skip through this. You can probably read this faster than me. Okay. So in summary, adolescents are made a major proportion of vulnerable children, and they're inadequately supported. Those affected by HIV or other crises are highly vulnerable to HIV and sexual reproductive ill health. We shouldn't target AIDS orphans, but we do need to identify the most vulnerable. We have to make policy and social protection. We have to make policy and social protection. I'm going the wrong way. Excuse me. education and prevention, complementary and integrated, in order to actually have any impacts on the dynamics of HIV. And the last slide here to conclude, we need to access in schooling, we need to invest particularly in access to schooling for the most vulnerable, also looking at the sources of stigma and discrimination that keeps some out of school, as well as economic issues. We actually need structural prevention approaches for these vulnerable adolescents, which better target the children most in need, which involve context-specific social and structural analyses. They have to emphasize social inclusion and social capital beyond the home. So social protection for the family is not going to be enough. We have to aim to transform inequitable gender attitudes and gender norms around sexuality and in communities. And finally, within such solutions, it's crucial that the relevant children most vulnerable to HIV need to be actively participating in the design of those programs, which is an obvious statement to many people, but still lamentably not being followed by most. Thank you. Oh, and here's just the names of some people I would like to thank who've contributed to pulling all of this together: Kelly Holmer, Richard Mabala, Lucy Kluver, Don Operaria, Doug Webb, Masuma Mamdani, and Alex Dewell, who are both on the learning group, and innumerable other people who've been involved in the studies. Thank you.
Good evening, friends. I'm glad to be representing the lessons from Learning Group 2, and I'll be doing this on behalf of our co-chairs for the Learning Group, but also the other group members that we worked with to start off this process of learning together.
Up the slides, please.
So I will be quickly sharing some of the lessons that we picked from the learning process in Learning Group 2. And just to set a few background points, that community action, which was our focus, is a part of the response to support children, because it is the first line of backup after the family as the safety net, and it also is the basis that defines the connectedness and social cohesion that is an important basis of what gets to be done, what gets to happen at community level. And after the family, it's been established in different studies that the community constitutes a substantial support to the work that needs to be done for children. Communities need additional support. They are doing a lot, but they need to be supported to do more, partly because they are overstretched by poverty and by the burden of numbers of children affected by AIDS. And enhancing the capacity to cope with the extraordinary demands that come with the prolonged care, with grief, and with orphanhood. And also the fact that AIDS has largely decimated the young adults who would have been the employed income earners at community level. So in looking at what kind of community initiatives exist in the community, in the work that we're looking at, we found a broad range of locally founded, locally based efforts, but also a substantial representation of external initiatives that work at community level. And it's important when we think about supporting the community response to think about supporting both kinds and supporting them from different perspectives. So the large proportion is mainly locally based, but the green and the lime are representation of some of the external responses that also exist at community level. And
The main characteristics of these different responses, one is that the community-based responses are mainly two kinds. The people-based responses that are mainly inspired by the visible need and are based on individuals. But there are also institution-based responses that in local churches, in some of the local schools and other community institutions, which would require a different kind of support. The external agencies come in with important resources, but it's important to know that their action lasts for a certain period of time, but they would be useful if they contribute to the building of local capacity for sustainability. In the work that we did in Uganda as part of Learning Group 2, we looked at the extent to which these community initiatives are accessing external resources. And it was encouraging to find that a substantial proportion, two-thirds of them, have actually accessed resources. And this is in the short-term access within the 18 months before we did the study. And many among these have received help from multiple sources. So you'll find that although there are those that have not received support at all, 35%, they are actually... Many have received support from the general community, and a substantial proportion, 35%, have received support from government, which is an important reflection of government's focus on this level in terms of helping what they are doing. And the form of support that these initiatives are getting is mainly in cash, but also a number of them are getting support in material form, and they did appreciate 41% support that they are receiving as technical support to strengthen the work that they are doing. The support they receive, we need to be sure that it is actually going beyond the initiatives and reaching the families. And in the communities that we studied where these initiatives were telling us the support they received, we found that half of the households have actually received services. And the services received at household level were more likely in female-headed households, 57% compared to 38%, and this is a reflection of the fact that many of the female-headed households were actually headed by widows. And the help that gets to the households is mainly child-focused, not family-focused, which is one of the things that has been encouraged from Learning Group 1. And we did find that even this child focus does not necessarily translate into reaching the children as equitably as they should be reached. Although we found that only one-third of the children in the households who needed help were actually accessing external help, and encouraging that there was no gender difference but a great age variation. The fact that it was the school age especially which was being reached by the help available, not as much the younger ones under six, and also the adolescents, not as much reached as has been reflected from Learning Group 4. The initiatives did indicate some problems with access to resources. Problems related to selective access, inequity in who accesses and who doesn't access resources, inadequate information on what resources are available or what are the effective initiatives in place. So information for the resource providers on the effective initiatives, but also information for the implementers on where they could go to get help. Resources are largely inadequate compared to the number of children that I need and the range of needs they have, and also the priorities that determine how resources flow are sometimes not well balanced between what the donors would prefer, what communities would prefer, and in many situations with no arbitrator standing in between the two. With that kind of picture of lessons from Uganda and from the other countries that Learning Group 2 focused on, we identified a number of things that we think need to be done as we look forward to improve what's happening at community level. Number one, to provide more resources. Secondly, to build capacity of community level actors to be able to access resources better in proposal writing, in partnership building and partnership negotiation. To work for the increased contact and information flow between donors and community initiatives, so that they can be able to understand each other, understand the opportunities, and also understand the challenges that need to be dealt with. Finally, we think that it is important for government to increase its visibility and role in connecting donors to initiatives, especially at the community level. While it's appreciated that at national level, district level, there is substantial progress in government coordination, at community level, this function is not being played effectively, and therefore, the coordination and harmonizing of priorities needs to be something that can be taken forward a little better. So those are some of the lessons that I thought I would be able to share with you, and I do appreciate the support and the contribution to this process by the other learning group members. Thank you.
Thank you very much. First of all, I wanted to pay tribute to Dr. Lydia Munguerera. Lydia was my co-chair for Learning Group 3 on Access to Services and Human Rights, and she couldn't be here because her wonderful NGO, Mama's Club, is receiving the Red Ribbon Award. So we hope that she'll be able to come here later. We've talked through these data, and we've looked at the data from a lot of different angles. Let me just point out a couple of quick things from these particular data. This is a study, actually, that Nathan carried out that in 2007, just 18% of needy children and less than 5% got outside support. Now, I purposely put this bottom number, 23% of HIV-positive pregnant women. Now, the new figure that was just released is 33%. But I put that 23% in because the question for me is, if a single dose of nevirapine counts as PMTCT, is that really effective coverage for PMTCT? We know that there are many ways of getting infected, even after delivery, and it's just simply not, I think, an effective way of measuring outcomes for PMTCT. But anyway, the point is clear, and it's been made over and over and over again. Children have been missed in this response. And, you know, we made it very clear, but and we keep pounding you over the head with it, but families care best for children. Some of the things, you know, institutional care, the outcomes that are worse in institutional care, and these are studies done in the U.S., respiratory infections, gastrointestinal infections, nutrition and growth deficits in verbal skills, cognitive development, the work that Jack Schoenkopf and others have done through the work on early childhood development has shown that social deprivation can actually lead to the malformation of neural connections, socioaffective development, of course, and physical and sexual abuse. So we've made the point again and again. Families need the services. Families are best. Institutional care is not good. And that targeting of programs have also been of limited use. But there's other data that's also, I would say, predictable but important to understand. First of all, antiretroviral therapy for parents improves all these indicators, household income, school attendance, stigma and discrimination. And children are freed from an average of 8.6 hours of labor per week when a single parent receives ART. And when both members are on ART, 79% of their 79% decrease we see in child labor. So treating the parents turns out to be terribly important for children. And moreover, we've learned that HIV-positive caregivers are more protective, that they're simply better caregivers, and that HIV-positive caregivers provide more informed support for their children. So instead of thinking about families living with HIV as these sort of devastated, hopeless institutions, what we know is that if we provide family-focused care for all of them, that we could think about this in a whole new way. Perhaps a family-focused approach to treatment could provide unity, continuity, knowledge, and strength. And again, these are things that have been suggested in our by folks who've been looking very carefully at the vast rollout of antiretrovirals that have had differential impacts on children. Now, I'm going quickly because I want to get to an example and of what we think might be a very interesting approach to family-centered care for children who are affected and living with HIV. We know that there's a huge implementation bottleneck. We know that despite all our efforts, services are still not reaching the poor. We know that, in fact, and if you look at that list carefully, I even put microbicides and other preventive tools. If we have all these new tools, and although it's not looking very good, if we do have all these new tools, how are we going to deliver them, given the very, very poor rate of delivery that that we're seeing throughout the world today? So one of the things that we did was, in this group, we took the notion of implementation very seriously. And as part of our work, we examined in great detail good examples. We determined what we thought were both good and bad examples of approaches to delivering care. In this case, we looked at a particular program based in Kenya. It is a partnership between Moi University College of Medicine and Indiana University. It's called the AMPATH program. This is a PEPFAR USAID-funded program. But the history of this program is terribly important because the history had a determining impact on the overall system design and the outcomes that they got. This started out as a collaboration around the building of a medical school. Moi University School of Medicine was a second medical school in Kenya, and the University of Indiana partnered with Moi University. Receiving very few resources from Indiana University, they made a commitment to build a medical school that would train a new cadre of individuals who would then provide primary care to the community. So the foundation of this project was primary care. Now, the elderly American white gentleman in the picture is Joe Mamlin. And Joe talks about an experience of being at Moi University and then coming back many years later in the middle of the HIV epidemic. And the hospital wards went from having, a few dozen patients in a day, or in a few dozen patients over a week period of time, to being just packed. And the hospital was packed with people living with HIV. And he remembers the day when he found one of his medical students living with HIV and basically dying. And this was in 2001, when in fact, back at his medical school, University of Indiana, people were living with HIV as a chronic disease. They decided to do something about it, and they decided to begin treating before they had any money. But from the beginning, they decided that the way to do this program was to build it on the foundation of their community-oriented primary care they had built for many years. So their program, from the beginning, looked very different from many programs in the developing world. It was integrated. It was a systems-based model. They focused on access to essential medicines. Nutrition and economic support were part of what they did. They had intensive local provider training. Their counseling and testing program was very different. They started provider-initiated testing very early. And I'll tell you a little bit later about their home-based counseling and testing efforts. Integrated care, their PMTCT was an integrated effort that was integrated with reproductive and child health, and also psychosocial support groups. They had a nutritional support program, and they began writing prescriptions for food, based on body mass index and food security assessments. And they even started growing food. They realized that they could get some dry foods from World Food Program, but they weren't the healthiest. So they began growing vegetables. It was called the Heart and Harvest Initiative. So growing fresh vegetables was part of their program to support families in the HIV treatment program. And, you know, they negotiated with the PEPFAR program and tried to get as much of these kinds of services paid for as possible, and they were only partially successful, but they paid for it and found funding for these other elements anyway. Now, they have another program that was actually very much focused on what they call the Family Preservation Initiative. In other words, they knew that poverty was a major problem. And not only did they try to move resources directly to families in the form of microenterprise lending initiatives, but they also tried to encourage savings. Julio Frank talked about the importance of beginning bank accounts and having savings. They set out with a specific focus of relieving poverty among the poorest, but also even moving them to the point where they would have savings. The home-based counseling and testing program is another example of how the family focus changed their system design in a way that at the end of the day was very, very useful. They were having success, but 85% of the catchment population did not know their HIV status. And the thing that broke Joe Mamelin's heart, now I'm quoting from Joe Mamelin, because during the PEPFAR meeting in Uganda this past year, Joe and I and Sylvester Kamaya, one of the physicians from Kenya, actually taught this case to the attendees of the meeting. So despite their success in general, they were having trouble. The thing that broke Joe's heart the most, he said, was that he never saw any discordant couples. By the time they reached care, they were all concordant couples. They had infected each other. So they put community mobilizers out to sensitize people to the fact that they were going to test in the home. They deployed counselors, used PDAs, personal digital assistants, and GPS systems. And what they got was 95% success in terms of people accepting to be tested. The cost was $259 a patient, and it looks like they're going to scale it up very effectively. Now, when we presented this case in PEPFAR, immediately people jumped up and said, but Joe, what do you do about discordant couples? What about confidentiality? And Joe's response was, well, on discordant couples, I pray that I find them. So there were problems. People said, weren't there cultural problems? Do you walk into people's homes and ask them to get tested? And Joe said that, you know, because they had engendered the trust of the community over so many years of building up a primary health care program, their entree to the homes through their outreach workers was far better than they had ever thought. Now, I'm just going to end by trying to draw some of the lessons from this particular example and build on the four major recommendations that Linda Richter made from our joint learning initiative. So the first is that policies, programs, and funding must be redirected to provide support for children to and through their families. Now, I would argue that here, in the AMPATH case, because it started with community-based primary care focused on families, they had no option but to think about the family in all aspects of their program design. This is not where a lot of programs start. And in fact, in rethinking policies fundamentally, how would you be able to build a program like that when funding from the major donors comes in the form of not only vertical money, but subvertical money? One large NGO in a country will receive money for PMTCT. Another large NGO receives money for VCT. Another large NGO receives money for ARVs. By design, it's fragmented and is much more difficult to concentrate on the family. You know, why don't we call social protection PMTCTP, preventing the mother-to-child transmission of poverty, as Julio Frank suggested? It's absolutely critical. When we talk about social protection and cash transfers, this is not a program. It's a fundamental moral principle that we think we have to embrace once again in our program design. It's wonderful to declare a value that we think poverty is bad and we should move towards social protection. But we've got to see that in our program design, and we've got to see that in how money flows to communities. On cash transfers, you know, I've been watching this very carefully, and it seems to me that the donors today have tremendous faith and trust in NGOs, even the so-called suitcase NGOs that have come out of the dust and are now accepting huge amounts of this money. So if you pay for overhead in Washington, D.C. or any other capital, and if you pay for overhead in the capital city, and if you pay for trucks, and if you pay for international consultants, you are a trusted recipient of funding. But when it comes to moving money directly to poor families, to poor women, all of a sudden we become suspicious. What did the microenterprise lending programs teach us? It taught us that very poor women make great economic decisions. The data that is overwhelming from the cash transfers is that women who are too poor to even participate in microenterprise lending programs, that when you give them cash unconditionally, they also make very good choices. We would argue that moving money directly to families, taking an approach that builds on family structures, that supports them in all their needs, is affordable right now if we remove all the money that we're spending on overhead and consultants. We can do it today. So, you know, one of the best parts of a joint learning initiative is that you spend a lot of time with some fantastic people. I'm so grateful to all the people that we've worked with. And I think the true sign of whether joint learning has happened or not is if you spend a lot of time arguing with and screaming and yelling at each other, and we did that. But in the process of doing that, I think we came to some really clear recommendations that we'd like to make. And I thank you for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all of the panelists. And we do have a little bit of time for comments or questions from those of you who are out have been in the audience. And I want to encourage you to step up to the microphone. And we will perhaps take three or so comments at a time and then let the panel respond. Please. Thank you very much, and I also appreciate the brevity of your question. Thank you. I hate to ask this of you, but could I ask you if you try to ask your question in one sentence, if that's possible?
My question infers the idea of suggestion.
think so. I'm not sure we're going to be able to answer that last question, although I'm looking out at Alex DeWall, who is the co-chair of the Learning Group on Economic and Social Policies. Alex, do you have anything to respond to this? Let's try to respond to some of these questions that have been asked.
Sure. I'll try and put them all together because...
Can you hear?
Can you hear? I can hear. Hello? Should we sing? La, la, la. There's a theme consistent in three of the questions, which is about small groups of very at-risk children, the ones with no family at all, the ones with disability and street children. I would say absolutely we agree with you. Strangely, just as I'm thinking about the literature, I don't recall one study which looked at disability, despite the fact that my analysis of all the cognitive showed 81% of the children had a problem with cognitive development across the studies. So really, if you want evidence-based policy, we have to start somewhere. But I would say that for many children, there is someone. Of course, we have to have policies for that small minority of children where there's absolutely no one. But we have got possibilities to create. But we shouldn't have policies driven by that group only. We should have policies for the majority and for the ones who don't have any access to any family. We've really failed as a society, and we really have to put something in place.
Yeah, is it on? Okay. Just to maybe add, I won't. We didn't come across studies on disability either, and we weren't particularly looking for it, to be honest. And it seems like a very sensible, one of the many very sensible things to do in terms of continuing to unearth the specific vulnerabilities of specific groups of children, which also include children who are not living in homes or living on the streets, sometimes part-time on the streets. And I would very much agree with the two questions there. We certainly can't forget the fact that some children leave home for very good reasons, because their home is not a safe place, and they need other alternative care arrangements. Now, there are lots of debates around that, and there is research around that as well, and we do know that institutional care is a very bad idea for most children, and that family-like solutions are often better. But even so, some children, and particularly adolescents, are sometimes not receptive to that and will end up living in child-headed households or gangs on the street and so on. And we need to find other solutions for them which actually involve them in those solutions, because they're fairly resilient, those kids. They know how to survive, and they also know how to plan ahead, even 14 years ahead, and maybe they should be involved in that planning process. Thank you.
Just add one quick thing. I think that we were in our group certainly very, very sensitive to the needs of street children and children truly who were abandoned. Of course, that's a concern. I think that the reason we're focusing so much on families is that there was a tendency to build institutions, and the building of the institutions was a method of having a place to put children who impoverished families could no longer take care of because they were so impoverished. And what we're saying is that it's so much better to put money directly into the hands of poor families and not force them to have to make the horrific decision of putting them in an institution. That's a much better option. So that's really what we're talking about. I don't think we're saying that there should be no institutions for street children, for example. I think what we're saying is, if we change our focus, the huge numbers of families that have taken in orphans now and have suffered, you know, up to 25% of their household income loss every time they take care of an HIV-positive person, as some of the studies showed, and also do become more impoverished by taking in children. We think if we can support them, that those institutions could be even better for those children who really have nobody.
Nathan, did you have any? I don't think we responded to the question about the long-term balance. Section of HIV/AIDS with other sources of deprivation and other shocks that has the worst outcomes at community level. And therefore, the project that is in front of us, the logic of these findings, is that in order truly to get to grips with the deprivation, the plight of children affected by HIV and AIDS, we have to tackle child poverty and we have to tackle the limited constraints on governments. And unless those projects are also taken very, very seriously over the long term, then children affected by AIDS and all poor and vulnerable children in these societies are going to, for many years, to be exposed to unpredictable shocks which will further worsen the deprivation that they suffer. Who's looking at the plan? Frankly, I think there's a challenge before all of us. No one is seriously looking at all these issues together and coming up with solutions, and that's the challenge we should be taking on.
Let us ask for one more round of questions. Please.
Thank you. I'm Susan Strasser from the Elizabeth Glazier Pediatric AIDS Foundation in Zambia. First, just want to say thank you to Dr. Kim for highlighting the Empath program, which I've learned about a few years ago, and it just doesn't even have to be based on research. It just makes good common sense. And my question to you, I was a little bit late, so I may have missed it in the first two speakers, but in my experience with OVC programming, one of the biggest missing links is the recognition of and accountability of children's rights. And everyone in this room is signatory and are citizens of countries except myself from the United States and anyone from Somalia, of the Universal Declaration on Children's Rights. And in my experience, a lot of the insults that come from being an orphan related to poverty or HIV is the lack of those rights, the rights to birth registration, a right to citizenship, a right to social grants, a right to accountability that the children who are orphaned aren't separated and sent to different families, and that the children don't get all of their possessions taken by other family members. And I'm wondering if you've looked at the literature, the legal literature, of holding states accountable to the rights of children in those areas. There's some very good work in Lesotho looking at mixing customary and civil law on children and taking very practical approaches. Even if the state is constrained, human resource constraints and economically constrained, using customary law and civil law to protect children.
Thank you. And once again, please keep your questions brief, if you can.
Tim Evans, World Health Organization. Thanks to the speakers and panelists. Excellent. One question related to learning. Julio Frank identified that part of the success of Oportunidades is that they had targeting based on census tract information. And Lorraine, I believe you said that there was no ability to disaggregate data. And I'm wondering what JLI's recommendations are with respect to counting. It follows on the right to count, the right to be counted. But orphans in particular, I would imagine, or children affected by HIV/AIDS, may be missed by the very patchy vital registration systems in most low-income countries. And I would think that in order to learn how to better serve these communities, one might need to think about how to get more towards universal counting of children, all children, not only those children affected by HIV/AIDS. I'm just wondering in that regard what the recommendations of JLI are with respect to counting of children. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Lizzie DeSantis, and I'm with Physicians for Human Rights. And my question actually relates to the health workforce and how linking better social protection with strengthened health systems, what types of implications that will have on training and retaining health workers, and developing and financing, in particular, community health worker strategies.
Thank you. And just one final brief question, please.
My name is Zalalem. I'm from Ethiopia, Save the Children. My comment, I have one comment and one question. The family-centered approach might be not context-specific, I think. In countries like Ethiopia, where I came from, we have a very strong social capital, social fabric, and I think building on the social fabric will build the social capital of the society, and this family center might have been oriented to the to other cultures and might not be context specific when we come to the African context. So can we say that can we have a hybrid approach of family centered and social fabric approach centered approach? Thank you.
Thank you. Now, I have been informed that there is Mexican wine and cheese awaiting for us right outside, and there are other people who consider themselves claimant on that wine and cheese, and this audience has deserved it. So I've got to ask just the members of the panel if each of you might try to respond to one of these questions. Briefly, and then we can wrap up. And I hope that there'll be opportunity to continue conversation outside over the wine and cheese for some of us. We welcome all of you to join us. Please, Ray.
I'll respond to the legal rights question. I certainly have done rights on access to work on access to justice, and in fact, across Europe, have provided studies on providing lawyers. And I'd never thought of putting two together. And I think, hallelujah to you, we should get the children together. I should run next door and get the treatment action campaign. And the children should sue us.
Okay, very quickly. On the children's registration, I think it's a very good question. And I would definitely say yes, we should have... put a lot of emphasis on strengthening those kinds of capacities in societies. Just to point out that of course, most of the counting and census data and so on tends to be household-based, and when there will be some children left out, most likely, unless we come up with new and better methodologies.
Just a quick comment on the imperative of children's rights and how they would influence the agenda of programs. I think the evidence from Uganda points to how critical that is and the kind of difference that makes, especially when you look at the access to education. It's been one of the most talked about and promoted area of rights. And if you look at the work going on at community level, there is a substantial focus and progress in that area compared to the other areas. So certainly it's something that could inform the framework of programming and with potential to cause a difference.
On numbers, Tim, one of the things that we found was that all the numbers for kids are much worse than for adults. For example, we quote a 6 to 10% rate of children who need treatment on treatment, but we're much less sure about those than for the adults. So this is really a fundamental issue. And in the area of health workers, I think the other thing we found is that facility-based programs that say free care, and if you can get it, come and get it, those kinds of programs will discriminate against the poorest families and especially the poorest children. So I think without paid community health workers, we are not going to do very well in improving care for children. A facility-based model is bad for a lot of people. You know, again, some of the cash transfer data in Mexico was that very, very minor barriers to care, like bus fare, was what was keeping the poorest families from accessing free services. So in that sense, giving cash in the was a way of shoring up demand. So if we want the services to get to the children, giving the cash is one thing, but also being out there in the communities, making sure that treatment and care is available at the community level through paid health workers, I think is going to be clearly a big part of the design. And finally, on the rights-based issue, you know, under the leadership of Paul Farmer, we've just relaunched the Health and Human Rights Journal. And what we've decided that we're going to focus on is rather than focusing overly much on legal structures or policy issues, which we'll still do that, they're very important, but we're going to make a real attempt to document in great detail, in operational detail, how various efforts to assure human rights have been carried out so that we can derive from them general principles of how we might implement better or be more effective at assuring people's rights, even developing theories about how to practically assure people's rights, and sharing experiences in a way that will improve our overall delivery on our moral commitments to human rights.
Thanks to all of you for listening so patiently, for engaging us with your questions. And I very much hope that we can continue these conversations in smaller groups outside to the degree that time will permit. I want to, before thanking our panelists, want to at least point you to the brochure that you received on the Joint Learning Initiative, because I should be one by one thanking the institutional donors and partners who have worked with us to bring us to this point. We will continue our work over the next several months and hope to continue to refine and to develop recommendations that will become actionable proposals that eventually will make a real difference in the lives of children. It is that brings together this quite diverse group that makes up the Joint Learning Initiative. It is a common commitment to making a difference in behalf of the well-being of children. So many thanks for being with us, and please join us outside and thank our panelists.